This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Jason Horsley. He is an author and blogs at Ati Culture. Jason, it's great having you on the show.
Hi, Robert. Thanks.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
Hey, Jason.
Hey.
Ati Culture, it's a reference to autism and people on the autistic spectrum and with Asperger's. Can you talk about your personal experience with Asperger's and what kind of inspired you to put it in towards a blog and writings?
Yeah, I self-diagnosed Asperger's when I was 40, and I met my wife to be, who self-diagnosed as autistic, and I'd heard about it. I was somewhat familiar with it, but it fit, the shoe fit, so I tried it on, and it seemed reasonably comfortable, even though I wasn't one to take diagnoses or anything like that. I didn't want to be put in boxes, but this seemed like an interesting box to go into. I don't know, it just gave me a sort of map in terms of recalibrating my experience of always being alienated from society and from other human beings to some degree. And I'd incorporated into that into a more sort of spiritualized idea, which was that I was an alien hybrid, or I was the incarnation of some archetypal entity. And I had all kinds of versions to try and somehow reconcile myself to this just feeling of not being comfortable in my skin and in the world. So it was kind of helpful to turn that down a little bit or invert it a bit and say, okay, well, I'll take it as a diagnosis, even though I know I'm not going to try and cure it or anything like that. But it brought it down to earth somewhat. And the other thing that was interesting to me was the extent to which there were people like me out there who were these round pegs that didn't fit in the square holes of society, and so were being forced into kind of ways of being and identification that was really oppressive to them, and to some extent even being abused, treated in ways that were abusive, even murdered in extreme cases with autism. That sort of gave me a desire to recontextualize or reframe the whole idea of autism, or to contribute anyway to that movement, which is largely known as neurodiversity. And then the sort of more general interest that applies to everyone, whether they identify or not as on the spectrum, is the thing that I termed extra consensual perception, which is simply put is that we learn to perceive reality in a way that is limited and constricted by language and what we're trained and conditioned to talk about and believe is real. That's a sort of process of socialization through language and other technologies that cause us to shut down our perceptions and filter out many things that actually they don't fit with that map that we're given.
There's this kind of notion that Asperger's is a disability, but there's also, if you feel that if you're not connected with other people and with society in general, either if you reject society intentionally or if you make an effort to conform. And some people who make an effort to conform and they fail at that, and some people just sort of reject the values of society. I think you either kind of go into two ways of thinking. You either feel like you're a loser or inferior, or you feel that, as you kind of said, this like human-alien hybrid, that you're more advanced on a higher level than other people, and that those other people, like conformist masses, like those people are below you. Do you see Asperger's as a disability, or could you make the case that people with Asperger's are more highly evolved?
Well, I don't think I'd make either case. I mean, it's like in terms of disability, I mean, that's a very loaded term, but even if we would say social maladaption, dysfunctioning, being somewhat dysfunctional socially, you can definitely make a case for that. I was pretty high functioning on that spectrum. Like, I was always able to pass, is what they call it in the autistic community, in quotes. There isn't really a community. That's kind of the paradox that I intended with autoculture, because autism is inward. It's inward orientation. So it's kind of, we are to a large extent kind of immersed in our own internal world, and that can definitely be dysfunctional, insofar as we might not be able to read the social cues very well. We can't tell irony or a joke, and we take everything literally. These are some obvious examples. I mean, I did have these experiences growing up. I also didn't like to be physically touched, and so on. I mean, one can go through the list. It's become kind of a cliche now, the whole, you know, the autistic characters in all these TV shows and all the rest of it. And often there is the element that they are somehow more evolved or more psychic or more this or more that. And my view is quite skeptical about that, because I think that the culture of the society that on the one hand diagnoses and denigrates, it also lifts up and idealizes, like it was done with the Native Americans. They were being slaughtered wholesale on the one hand, and on the other hand they were being turned into this culturally quaint sort of social phenomenon, and, you know, romanticized basically. So that those two things can go hand in hand, and I don't think either is accurate. That's actually, ironically, that's a neurotypical way of thinking, that if something is different, it must be understood as better or worse. Like neurotypical thinking, it's all hierarchical and it's all value based. And so just the idea of something being different without an accompanying value judgment that this is good or bad is really difficult for neurotypicals. Whereas the part of neurodiversity is thinking outside the box, is the cliche, right? We don't have to attach the socialized or the socially endorsed and enforced meanings to stuff, as in, you know, is this good or is this bad? Is this a survival advantage or is it a survival disadvantage? Those obviously they're relevant, but they're not the whole criteria by which we could understand this.
Well, the thing is, one trait that's associated with Asperger's is that these individuals are nonconformist.
Yeah.
So a lot of people with those traits are more likely to come up with their own visions or unique ideologies. I think a lot of disproportionate numbers of famous intellectuals, artists, and scientists have either been diagnosed or sort of people speculate about whether they have it.
Yeah, and Silicon Valley as well, of course, there's a preponderance of spectrumites in Silicon Valley. I relate that to the innovators and the imitators, and this is a social model. I don't know where to attribute it to, but I heard it somewhere and I thought, aha, that sounds interesting. And the basic premise is that the societies or the species even is made up of a majority of imitators, the people who are just naturally hardwired to imitate, with a small portion of innovators, and it works together. You only need a few innovators, because if you have too many, they won't, you know, the things that the new behaviors or the new procedures won't get adapted, because everyone will just keep innovating and nothing will stick. But then if you have all imitators, then nothing new comes in and it atrophies and falls apart. So you've got that balance of a few innovators and then the larger collective of imitators that sort of choose at an unconscious level which behaviors, which innovations to imitate, and then establish as part of the social norms.
I also think people use that term, Asperger's, to kind of describe anyone who they view as being kind of quirky or nonconformist. I mean, you mentioned one of the traits is picking up social cues.
And yeah, not being able to.
Rather. Not being able to pick up social cues. With me personally, like, I'm very good at picking up people's social cues. I understand irony, sarcasm, so I don't fit those characteristics, but in my case, in the past, I've struggled with anxiety, and that's been a hindrance to communicating, connecting with other people, anxiety, and also I'm definitely a strong nonconformist. So I've had people in the past say I had Asperger's, but I mean, I don't know if I necessarily do. People just throw that out, that label out all the time.
Sure. Yeah, well, it isn't. I mean, this is a sort of, there's a paradox. I said somewhere that autism is a one-word oxymoron. It self contradicts, because the thing about autism is it's non-neurotypical, which means that it's people, organisms, let's say, that don't take socialization, they don't imitate well, so they don't assume the behaviors that are given to them, so they remain in a certain sense anomalous. Because what society is and how society functions is that we learn the social behaviors, and we learn the cues, and we imitate, and we learn the language, and we internalize it. And so our sense of self and how we express it become one thing, really, how we perceive ourselves and how we express ourselves. And it's all through the social. It's like learning a language at a sort of deep biological level. So we can only express what we have words for. And so we all become like cookie cutters. You know, we've come through the cookie cutter mold, and we're all more or less the same, right? And that's how we can agree. It's, how are you? I'm fine. We've got all these cues, and we obey them, essentially. We give the answers that were expected, even if we don't mean them. So autism is a spectrum at which the furthest end is a complete rejection of the social program, so that individual is completely unsocialized, and that means they're completely unique in a certain sense. I mean, biologically they're similar, although there'd be different neurological differences, but in terms of their self, it's unrecognizable, because I mean, maybe they don't even speak language, so they wouldn't necessarily be similar. Like two autistic people could be more different than an autistic and a neurotypical.
You wrote a post on your blog about the whole 4chan meme culture and Pepe the Frog and Keck.
Yeah.
Do you see 4chan culture as a synonymous with Asperger's and the autism spectrum?
Well, no. I mean, I haven't hung out at 4chan for one thing, but even if I had, I wouldn't be able to, you know, identify all these people and get a real sense of what they were like. So that's a very broad stroke. But I mean, I think what's going on there is there's a single phenomena that is being perceived from countless different angles and given countless different names and sort of coming into form in different movements and what have you. So you've got ADHD, you've got schizophrenia in the old days, you know, autism was initially called child schizophrenia. You've got psychism, you've got 4chan, you've got hackers, you've got these different cultures and subcultures and diagnostics and whatnot. And it may be a single phenomenon that's occurring, which is what I'm trying to express here, which is that I think when a society becomes over-complexified, socialization process becomes oppressive. And so there's a counterbalancing reaction against that, which is that there's more and more individuals who simply won't take the program. Like, it's like foot binding in China. Like, it's so restrictive that it basically distorts your ability to walk straight or talk straight. So although there'll still be people who submit to that and can endure it in this twisted form, there's kind of more and more people who are at some level just saying no to the program because it's so life destroying, I would say. It's so oppressive and it's so distorting. So then 4chan would be an expression of that, and that would overlap with the larger expression of autism, and which overlaps with, you know, schizophrenia and interest in conspiracy theories and it's all like this. So for me, it's about anomalies and, as I say, extra consensual perception. Like, what to what extent are our perceptions being Have they been compromised and sabotaged by the social program? And what is it that we're not perceiving because of that?
It's interesting how society has evolved. So in the past, people had these strong tribal communities where they were forced to conform to the values of society. And now our culture has become more atomized, where people spend a lot of time online and people are more disconnected. So on one hand, modern society leads to more social isolation and disconnection from one another. But then people who are nonconformists, whether they're Asperger's or not, they form their own like subcultures online, but they struggle more connecting with people in day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's a lot, and they do a lot. And I mean, I have that experience daily because I work in the thrift store in the day, not every day. And then I do my online work. So I've joked that it's like Clark Kent and Superman, which is perhaps a bit vain. But in terms of when I'm online and I can do my thing like now and I can talk my talk and it's really fun and I really can sort of embody this awareness I have, as you say, non-conformative, extra-consensual, and so on. And that feels liberating, but it is quite virtual. I mean, it is at the keyboard and et cetera. When I'm in the thrift store, people just want to know how much this costs and this, that, and the other. And I do, although I don't have social anxiety like I used to, I still find it difficult to interact at that very mundane, ordinary level.
You're saying like small talk as opposed to intellectual discussion.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, that's a part of it. It's not only that, but yeah, if somebody wants to hang around and talk, I want to connect to that person, and you know, I want to be part of the community and so on. But to guide the conversation away from the social norm of talking about the weather into areas that really might be meaningful is very difficult. It takes a lot of skill to do that without just blurting out, hey, have you heard about MK Ultra and mind control, whatever it is that's on my mind at that time, right?
Do you think there are genetic or occult reasons for the existence of autistic or Asperger's people?
Genetic. Yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, everything's genetic to some degree. I would say epigenetic is this current trend, and that's like nature and nurture being recognized as a single thing, which is logical if you think about it, because the nurture we're getting is coming from nature in the sense that everything is part of nature. So this is an interesting paradox, isn't it? Because I've talked about how society is dehumanizing and oppressive and restrictive and all those things in a way that nature wasn't once upon a time when we were more at harmony with nature. But this is what nature's created through us as human beings. I would say that the genetic element to autism has to be epigenetic, and it's inseparable from the way in which the technology we are creating is shaping us.
It's interesting to think about things in this genetic-wise, particularly if you think about autism like that. I mean, my one friend John showed me... did you write a book called Homo Serpiens?
I did. It's funny you mention it because I just got an email about that, and it's very rare that I do. But yeah, I did.
What is it exactly about?
Well, the subtitle is An Occult History of DNA from Eden to Armageddon. And this was back in my pre-self-diagnosis days when I thought that I was some sort of cosmic avatar who was bringing the word of the new aeon or some crap like that. I mean, I went pretty far up, I want to say my own asshole. I don't want to be too hard on myself, but I just took on these very complex philosophical ideas relating to occultism and DNA and all the rest of it. But the basic premise was to do with belief systems and how, how we can sort of map the changing belief systems in human culture as a process by which DNA becomes conscious of itself and that we become fully conscious of our genetic heritage as human beings. So Homo sapiens was this idea that I had back then of a fully awake human being that would be aware of all of his genetic material, so would be fully conscious, so therefore would remember being an amoeba in the swamp all the way, you know, from every human generation up to the present, including the memories of his ancestors and so on. It was this very, I would say, highfalutin idea of a cosmically awakened human being.
Can you talk about your interest in the occult, how you got interested in the occult? Are you just studying it from a purely academic basis, or do you believe that the occult relates to a lot of these issues we're talking about?
I like that question. I mean, I'm not academic, and I never have been. I mean, I didn't even go to university. I have published for a couple of academic presses, and my next book is for an academic press. But that's sort of coincidental. And at this point, I'm glad if people can read my stuff and not know, like, am I just approaching this academically, so to speak, or am I a believer? Because I don't know at this point. So I got into the occult through astrology, which was helpful to me in a time of personal distress. And then through Carlos Castaneda and his books, which were so mesmerizing about sorcery, and then that led me to Aleister Crowley, and I just took to it like a fish to water. I just somehow it provided me with the framework by which to, I would say, rationalize and spiritualize my trauma and my dysfunction and turn it into some. And David Bowie, actually, you know, if I was going to trace it back further, I'd say listening to David Bowie as an adolescent, that probably seeded me with this idea. I just read a quote about Bowie saying that he didn't want to be just a fragile human, he wanted to be the Superman. Well, I felt like that as an adolescent, probably many adolescents do, but I took it seriously enough to really pursue it, and to the extent of taking a lot of psychedelics and having experiences, that dreams and visions that confirmed this worldview, including experiences that I thought were alien contact or contact with some other level of intelligence. Even Lucifer, like I felt I'd make contact with the archetypal entity or consciousness of Lucifer. And I mean, deep, dark stuff. And I do think it's absolutely real, in the sense that the human unconscious is absolutely real and much more substantial than our fragile, puny conscious minds. You know, that's just a veneer on top of this, you know, thousands of years of archaic atavistic behaviors and beliefs and practices and all the rest of it. So I was tapping into that, but I made the mistake that people always do. I took it literally as this is real, in the same way that you know, a knife and a fork and a table are real. I didn't think they were physically real, but in the sense that I was underestimating the extent to which the language I was learning was shaping my own perception of these phenomena. So I learned the language of the occult, thinking this was a way to free myself from the social endorsed distortion of reality, that everything is just materialism, right? But actually, it was kind of like another, like a second matrix that I was being lured into, under the illusion that I was becoming free. But actually, I was just entering into a much larger, more complex sort of delusional system. And I'd say that's my view of occultism at this point.
Hey, Leader, did you get a chance to listen to that show I did with Aleister Crowley with Paul Bingham?
You did a show with Aleister Crowley.
Yes.
That would be impressive.
Yeah. I think I was listening, that I was learning more about, you know, I have the copy of the Book of Lies. Actually, I bought it when I was 18, and I just liked it because of the pretty images, but I didn't really understand the deep occultist stuff to it. But, you know, I really can't say much about Crowley other than the fact that there is this certain interest in occultism, and that if you practice it, maybe some kind of magic might happen. As we were previously talking about such phenomenon like meme magic, you post a joke online, and then eventually if the joke becomes real, then what happens, things become real in real life, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's back to the unconscious again, really. It's like, what's driving us, what's driving history itself, is the unconscious. You know, people are doing things for unconscious reasons. They might say, I'm going to bring about the new age and usher in the age of the Superman and whatever it is, but actually they're practicing genocide of whole peoples, for example, to use a very obvious historical example. There's this conscious intention, then you see the methods that are being used, and then it's very clear that the conscious intention is just the smallest part of the unconscious engine that's driving these behaviors. So then occultism is about trying to hack into one's own unconscious and harness the forces therein towards one's own transformation, which I would say is pretty much doomed to failure, precisely because we would be doing that for unconscious reasons itself. If you see what I mean? We're hacking into our own unconscious to try and harness it, but we're unconscious of why we're doing that.
You interviewed a James Howard Kunstler, and he was a guest on this show.
Oh.
And what's interesting is you kind of talk about with him the way architecture functions and urban planning and how that relates to the human psychology, how people feel, how they relate to one another.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was, I won't say it was entirely new to me, but I hadn't. So, I mean, it was particularly the context that he was talking about, these people making buildings to cause people distress, I thought was pretty interesting. I don't know. I mean, that's Jim's department, so I'm not sure if I have a great deal to comment on that.
Well, I do think certain types of architecture can inspire a certain psychological response. There's your sort of typical American suburban landscape, which is very, very depressing, boring. There's some forms of maybe architecture, communities like that you might find relaxing or soothing. And then some architecture might inspire like a strong sense of excitement. Or a harshness to it, but it also an excite something kind of have a strong impression on you. So it is amazing like how your environment, the effect it has on the human psyche. And the same is true of a geographical location, whether you're in the desert or the mountains or a forest or sailing in the ocean.
Yeah, well, that's something that I have noticed many times and been surprised at how I forgot to notice it. In the sense that, as in, I would move locations and I would feel so much better. Like, basically, if I'd move out of the city and into the country, I would feel so much better so quickly. And I was like, it's incredible, when I'm in the city, I just override the part of me that's telling me, not to get out, but just telling me that I don't feel good here. And, you know, like the body is constantly signaling us, but we have developed the ability to override those signals and just kind of sweat it out, and to our detriment. So I think what Jim is looking at, to some degree, or maybe largely what we're both looking at, is the way in which we create environments that will be oppressive to us, but that they're also, it's like we're externalizing something. So like, you couldn't create an environment that was kind of soul destroying if your soul hadn't already been pretty destroyed to begin with. Because and what that means is like psychic traumatization from childhood, from early childhood experiences, causes a disconnect between the conscious mind and the body and the larger psyche and the unconscious. And then we're boxed off in this sort of mind realm, which will create these endless sort of constructions in which to hide in and explore, but they will just perpetuate the dissociation. So I'd say that's what Jim's looking at, like dissociated species creates this architecture and social structures and all the rest of it that perpetuate the dissociation and just deepen it. And I think we're in a downward spiral that's accelerating, like just going deeper and deeper into dissociation, and that architecture is just one of countless ways that you can map that.
You have a lot of interesting psychedelic artwork on your website. Do you design that?
Well, it's not psychedelic. I mean, obviously that's a subjective thing, but it definitely isn't meant to be psychedelic. Let me put it that way. I do design it. I mean, I get a photo of a guest, and then I just find images and just sort of make something that I think will be appealing out of it. I guess I do still have a psychedelic bent, as in I like colors and weird shapes and stuff.
Do you have one for yourself that represents you?
Of the artwork?
Kind of one of you, but how you do with the guest?
Well, yeah, because there's been a few podcasts where I didn't have a guest. So it was just me. So then I had to liminalize myself there.
It's interesting that we're talking about dissociation and about how we become connected to things that are familiar with oneself, and especially about architect, where we want to relate to certain things where we feel comfortable with. And so, yeah. Especially with autism in that spectrum, somebody might have a fixation such as board or card games, and then might hang out at the board game store and only prefer to play board and card games with other people. The same thing is with video games. You have a certain video game you only play, you might be really good at it. Like, say you play Doom and you play that game over and over again, and you only hang out and talk about that as it's the talking. So there's this thing like online too, where this is happening within culture, where there's this whole culture online called weeb culture, where it's just people who love anime and they associate their life as an anime, and then almost get confused with reality as an anime, and then look through their lover as pretty much a real life anime character, and it becomes almost at that point cultural. So do you think autism could almost help create countercultures, or at least unique cultures that are exclusively on the internet that could possibly become realized in real life?
I guess I think that speaks to that oxymoron again, which is that autism relates to an inward orientation and a sort of a journey inward rather than a journey outward. So although autists can create these online communities, well, first of all, there's a paradox there, because they wouldn't want to meet up in real time because they're autists, right? They're much more comfortable at their keyboards. But the deeper paradox is that I would say that what autism is pointing to is this thing called the Kim Tunes, which I doubt many of your listeners have heard of. It's very obscure, but it was based on facilitated communication, which is when autists or people who are very neurodiverse, they can't communicate verbally, and it's generally often assumed that there's nobody home, that they're just mentally brain damaged or what have you. But there's been discoveries, I think the reason I jumped, I think that was partly written through facilitated communication. Anyway, certainly it seemed as though he wasn't particularly aware or intelligent until he wrote a book, and then like, holy crap, there's really somebody there, and a remarkable somebody. Anyway, Kim Tunes was about it used this method to get messages from some of these people who couldn't communicate otherwise, and one of the things it revealed, if it was true, was that these autistic individuals or organisms, I want to call them, because they're not people, right? They don't have constructed identity selves. They were communicating through means unknown, let's say, because I don't want to use words we've already been given, but they were able to communicate at long distances with each other through something other than the internet, through something other than technology, just biologically. And I think that's true. I mean, I can believe that we are able to communicate with each other at long distances through some unknown biological means. It's been called telepathy, but I think that puts the focus on the mind and like a mind-to-mind interface, and I think it's more energetic. So that I think that would be, I guess that's what I'm hoping to discover with autoculture, this idea of a culture that is completely uninfiltrated by the culture at large, which I think is toxic and destructive and dehumanizing, because it's not but why the culture is dehumanizing, but that we can the way that our inner horticulture is uncontaminated is that it's well, because it's inward, actually. I kind of lost the thread there, but yeah, it's a subtler signal that is connecting all of us, that is sort of pre-exists our socialized, culturized selves. So it's kind of primal, like a primal connection. And I think that there's probably evidence for this in terms of the Earth as a planetary system, and animals, like the way that animals pick up similar practices, like they say about the blue tits with the milk bottles. There was a in the old days in England, they would put milk bottles on the doorstep, and it was fine for years and years. But then at a certain point, suddenly all these blue tits were pecking the milk bottles and drinking the milk. But it happened really, really fast. So it's like one blue tit figured it out, and then somehow that information was passed on to all the rest, and they just picked it up very quickly. So I think there's a biological equivalent to the internet, which is energetic, and that's the real culture that we are, we have the option of plugging into.
You have a book out, Seen and Not Seen, Confessions of a Movie Autist, and you also have a website, movieautist.com, but you ask a lot of different interesting questions, and there's certain movies that I think have certain appeal to people with Asperger's or certain characters. One question you ask is the character Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver autistic?
Yeah, I didn't really discover that until I wrote that book, and some of that book is a reworking or looking back over movies I'd written about the first book I published, The Blood Purse, and having a dialogue with myself and discovering hidden things about why I was drawn to those movies and what I was trying to do when I wrote about them back in 1998. And really surprising myself. So yeah, Taxi Driver was a formative movie for me. Like, I identified very heavily with Travis Bickle as a teenager, same time as identifying with Clint Eastwood. So it's almost like the dark and the light. Like, in my fantasies, I was Clint Eastwood, but some part of me knew that really, if I were to really act out that, I would just be Travis Bickle, right? And so. But I didn't really get to the bottom of that identification until I wrote Seen and Not Seen, and I thought, holy crap, he's autistic. Like, he shows all of these very clear autistic qualities, the isolation and the inability to connect, and so on.
One thing about Paul Schrader's films, both Taxi Driver and Mishima, is that they're from the viewpoint, the lens of the one character who's the protagonist, and this individual, sort of this one person against the world, as opposed to regular movie. Most movies are just a bunch of people interacting, and I think those types of films have a unique appeal to people with Asperger's.
Yeah, I suppose, but I mean, that whole idea of the lone individual against the world is popular throughout. You know? That's an American trope as well, which I thought was what was interesting about Taxi Driver, was it took that cliche or that archetype of the John Wayne figure and showed that, well, in real life, no, this character would be a very lonely, unhappy, dysfunctioning and destructive individual. And that's not necessarily true of autists, of course, but in fact, it's more true of the neurotypical thing. But when, like, Travis is trying to get into society, he's trying to find a way to become socialized and become acceptable and to become a person like other people, are the words he uses. And the only way he can do it in the end, because he can't get the woman, he can't consummate some sort of the way that society's telling him, you know, to be a person like other people, you've got to find a woman you love and have sex with her, give her flowers and do that whole thing, you know, just become a breeder or what have you, just a social cliche. He can't do that, so then he acts it out through violence and ironically becomes a hero because the society, like he has figured out the right signal, for a violent sort of revenge-driven society is to commit a violent act of revenge, and you can get raised up as a heroic figure.
And that's an interesting concept, because a lot of people, if they struggle to connect with other people socially, they feel that they have to do something great to get attention or even narcissistic supply. It could be something, an accomplishment, like a creative accomplishment or some kind of success, but it could also be an act of violence as well, as you said.
Yeah, because that's become a cliche now, natural born killers and stuff, post Charles Manson, what have you, that the, you know, violent killers do get a lot of media attention and they get letters from women wanting to marry them in prison and so on. So it's a pretty good measure of how our society is, the extent to which it's become unmoored from anything real or human, is that you can be idealized or raised up through acts of violence, but I think it's also an indication of what you're suggesting, which is the desire to be a somebody in itself, the desire to impress others, is a kind of violence. Actually, Marshall McLuhan said it very well. He said that all forms of violence are quests for identity.
You've spent extensive time traveling around the world. Would you say some cultures are more nurturing than others, and some are harsher for people who have these traits that we're discussing?
Well, I think in general, I mean, I think if they're harsher for people that we're talking about who whatever the difference is, then they're going to be just harsher in general. And so, I mean, my experience traveling, the countries that I felt more at home with the culture and with the people have been poor countries, Mexico and Guatemala. But I don't think it's just because they were poor, because I've also been in Morocco and I certainly didn't feel it there. My God. I think there's more than just poverty there. But I think poverty or simplicity is a big factor. I think one of the problems in Morocco was that it's much stranger and more different, so it's very hard for me to find a way to not just be seen as an alien outsider there, and so to kind of react against that, and it created a sort of polarization. Whereas in Guatemala, I was able to, I wouldn't say blend in because I stand out physically, but I learned the language, and I generally felt at home there, and I would say that what I was talking about earlier in terms of the more complex a culture becomes, the more oppressive, the more violent, in a particular kind of violence anyway. So then, yeah, I mean, that's the measure I would use, is in terms of the more simple and the less developed a culture is, probably the more benign it is.
Jason, you're also a fan of David Lynch. Did you write about a Blue Velvet in your book?
I absolutely did, yeah. I'm more of an X fan. I mean, one of the things that Seen and Not Seen maps is my emergence from fandom, like my sort of pulling the veil away from my eyes about culture and this idea that it's somehow benign thing. But Blue Velvet was a very formative movie, and it helped me to see my own complicity with the darkness, because I identify with Frank Booth, as does David Lynch, I know. And so I it was a process of becoming more conscious. I read Crime and Punishment during the same period, more conscious of that sociopathic somebody within myself. And yeah, it was a very long period to integrate it. And I would say that Seen and Not Seen, it's got, the term confession is non-ironic. Like, there's some pretty dark stuff that I confess to, and they're not murders or anything. But in terms of my predilection for violent imagery, violence against women,
You're talking about not violent acts, but like violent fantasies or
yeah,
not psychological even, dark
yeah.
side.
Yeah, not even fantasies, but that I was drawn to movies that did appeal to that. They were, the movies themselves were fantasies, not like Blue Velvet, but because that was addressing it, and I think in a cathartic way. But there are also violent slasher movies that I would enjoy at a purely, like a base level, like people watch porn. I mean, torture porn is a phenomenon now, so actually the times have caught up with me.
You felt... powerless and disconnected, and you had anger and rage towards society, or was it just sort of there's just an appeal of violence?
No, it definitely wasn't just an appeal of violence. I mean, because that's very Sam Peckinpah. Like, there is a primal part of us, like Fight Club. I think this, but it wasn't that. It was sadistic violence, and there's nothing healthy about that. And to answer your question, it was, and this is what I uncover with Seen and Not Seen. So I could say, just read the book. But I won't. I'll sum up. One of the things I came to realize writing that book was that it was anger against my mother. Like, she was a very frightening presence, and I was powerless as a child. And so where did that anger go? It had to get suppressed into the unconscious. And so then it got turned inward against myself. So then I used this imagery of violence against women in a sense to torment myself or to punish myself. I had no idea at the time, but it was effective. Like, I hijacked my libido for quite a period by using that imagery, which is why I know that something like porn, whatever the changing times tell us, is not harmless at all.
Jason Horsley, I'd like to thank you for being on. We've covered a lot of really fascinating topics.
Yeah, thanks. It was a very fun. I don't usually talk this fast or in this way, but I figured we were restricted. So, yeah.